leaving him seemed to double in weight each minute she delayed, so that if she didn't go right then, she would never go. But she had learned too many secrets, done too much harm to too many people whose wealth and power were exceeded by their arrogance and by their cherished and implacable malignity. If she walked away from this grim fight, her enemies would never stop hunting for her, and they would eventually find her. Finding her, they would also find him. No foreign country was far enough away, no lifestyle too humble, no false identities too cleverly woven to thwart them in their search. Not when they had numerous eyes in the heavens, maybe 100 million cameras here below, and the growing internet of things that would one day give them undetected access to every room on Earth. And so she kissed Travis's cheek as he stood grooming Hannah, and she said that she was going for a walk. And she went into the house by the back door, and out the front door, and to her car, and away. The road before her blurred and darkling as if storm-swept, though the day was blue and bright. Now, in the Mendez family's half-bath, she regarded her mirror image and knew that, without doubt, she would be able to commit the horror she had been contemplating. In the defense of the innocent, not just her son, but also the uncounted others whose souls had been or would be harvested by the Arcadians, she would incur no mortal stain requiring that she stand before the judgment of eternity. However, she would be a fool if she believed that the act she was about to commit would not haunt her for the rest of her life. And she was no fool. 28. In this season, the cooler mornings were for horses, and like other mornings with horses, this last Saturday in March provided idyllic hours of peaceful rhythms, simple nature scenes and graces abundant, with no jarring note or alarming turn until they stopped for a creekside lunch in the shade of cottonwoods. Saturday morning, little more than an hour after first light, Gavin Washington had saddled the stallion, Samson, and young Travis had sat smart upon the pony, Hannah, and together they had ridden into the eastern hills of Orange County, where the chaparral was green from all the recent rain. There were still a few clouds in the wake of the previous night's storm, but they were unraveling like cocoon silk, as if the sky were some great blue-winged wonder that had emerged from them. They didn't talk much when they rode, because horses were a kind of meditation, which Gavin had long appreciated, and which the boy was learning. For a while, they proceeded at a slow walk, with just the clop of hooves, the rattle of dislodged gravel stones, the creaking of the leather saddles, and the occasional whispering of a fitful breeze through sage and feather grass, avena, and long-stemmed buckwheat. Rabbits startled off the trail into the brush, and lizards watched, wall-eyed, from perches on sun-warmed rock. They picked up the pace to a full walk when they turned north to put the morning sun on their right, but Gavin was not yet ready to let the boy ride at a trot, except in the fenced exercise yard on their property. High overhead, red-tailed hawks were gliding on the rising thermals, hunting mice and light creatures condemned to the rough life of the landbound. The aerial ballet of those predators could be mesmerizing, and Gavin warned Travis to give equal attention to the trail ahead. Although west-leaning shadows of brush and rock still patterned the ground, the day was now warm enough for rattlesnakes. They turned into an eastward-leading canyon, the walls of which sloped gently to a creek too swollen with recent rains to allow Travis to attempt his first fording. But the gentle grade of the ascending canyon floor offered an easy trail, and on their left, the ceaseless slide of surprisingly clear sun-spangled water over smooth stones was pleasing to both the eye and ear. Past 11 o'clock, they came to an open grove of cottonwoods and dismounted and walked the horses to the creek and held the reins, while Samson and Hannah drank, for the water was clean enough to give Gavin no reason for concern. There had been so much rain this season that the earliest storms had washed the Stony Creek bed clean of silt and debris. They let the horses graze the sweet grass that flourished in the open grove and beyond, perhaps not just because of the seasonal rains, but because of some aquifer under the canyon floor. They put down a blanket and sat in the shade to eat chicken sandwiches and drink iced tea from thermos bottles.
"Aunt Jessie does good sandwiches," the boy said.
"The entire reason I married her," Gavin said, "was her sandwiches, her homemade ravioli, and her peach pie."
Travis giggled.
"That's bourgeois."
"Oh, is it? Since when did you become a bourgeois expert?"
"You married her 'cause you love her."
Gavin rolled his eyes.
"What man wouldn't love a woman with such sandwiches?"
He heard a curious buzzing noise in the distance, like a power tool of some kind. But when he cocked his head to hear it better, the sound faded away.
"How's your sunscreen holding up, Travis?"
"I'm not burned or nothing."
"We'll apply some more before we set out for home."
Gavin was from birth as dark as fire-scorched mahogany, but the boy had Celtic in him and needed to culture a spring tan slowly.
"I wish I was black like you."
"Tell you what, we'll make you an honorary brother tonight after dinner."
"How's that work?"
"We put some Sam Cooke on the stereo and some shoe polish on you, and we say the magic words."
"That's so silly."
"I'll tell you something true that'll sound even sillier."
"Like what?"
"There used to be whales swimming around these parts."
"More bourgeois, Uncle Gavin."
"All this parched land and even far east into the true desert used to be a great deep sea."
"When?"
"Well, not last month, but 4 million years ago for sure. They found baleen whale fossils in these parts. If you'd been out here eating chicken sandwiches 4 million years ago, you might have ended up like Jonah in the belly of Leviathan."
The buzzing noise returned, and this time it grew steadily louder.
"What's that?" asked Travis.
"Let's have a look."
Gavin got up and moved through the open grove, away from the creek, to the tree line. The buzzing seemed to originate overhead. Using his hand as a visor, he shielded his eyes from the sun, but he didn't need to search the heavens for the sound. Cruising at perhaps 15 miles an hour, the quadcopter drone came from the east, below the canyon wall, like a 10-pound insect, a camera slung beneath it on a stabilization gimbal. Although these canyons and hills seemed remote, they were not far from civilization. Many of Orange County's scores of cities extended fingers into wild territory. On the other hand, he and Travis were not just around the corner from a housing tract of 1,000 homes. They had never encountered a drone out here before. There were numerous legitimate purposes for the intrusive damn things. Realtors filmed for sale properties with them, and surveyors made good use of them. But this was permanent open space, land that would never be given over to houses or office buildings or shopping malls.
"What's it doing?"
Travis asked as the drone approached. They were standing in the last shade of the trees. Gavin said,
"Step back,"
drawing the boy with him deeper into the cover of the cottonwood branches, where they lost sight of the buzzing craft and could not be seen.
"What's it doing?"
the boy asked again.
"Probably some techno geek playing with his newest toy."
"Way out here?"
"Better out here, where he won't screw up and fly it into someone's car windshield. Come on, let's get back to lunch before ants get what's left of our sandwiches."
They returned to the blanket in the cool shade. The open grove allowed space between the trees. If the drone had flown directly over the woods, the grazing horses might not have been entirely screened from above. Gavin could still hear the buzzing craft in the distance. He finished his sandwich in 2 bites and then brought the horses to a nearby tree. He tied them to lower branches where they now stood in full shade. don't want them getting overheated, he told the boy. We have brownies for dessert, if you're interested.
I would have married Aunt Jessie just for her brownies.
Back off, cowboy. I saw the lady first.
Gavin could hear two drones now, one more distant than the other. One perhaps tracking south to north, the other east to west. There might even have been three.
There's more of them, Travis said.
A whole damn club of geeks may be having themselves some kind of tournament, said Gavin,
leaning back against a tree trunk, pretending to be unconcerned. He wondered why he needed to pretend. His explanation was most likely the correct one. His and Jesse's friendship with Nick and Jane had been a relatively short one, and discreet. In the 2.5 months they had been sheltering Travis, not one of the legions searching for the boy's mother had connected them to her. In fact, if those hunting for Jane had suddenly linked Gavin and Jessica to her, the bastards wouldn't be chasing him and Travis with drones. They would be at the house, right now, with Jesse in custody, waiting for man and boy to ride home. Into their clutches. 29. When Jane entered the kitchen, Gilberto Mendez had not returned to his dinette chair and coffee. He stood by the sink, his spine straight and shoulders back and face solemn. Perhaps as he stood at the entrance to one of his viewing rooms when he welcomed mourners to their last sight of a loved one. Booth Hendrickson was still strapped to the gurney in a 3/4 sitting position. Gilberto had stuffed a roll of gauze in his mouth and firmly sealed his lips with duct tape. Even denied his voice, the Department of Justice Magnifico was able to convey his contempt by keeping his chin raised, his eyes narrowed, and his brow smooth. Jane sensed that behind the tape, his mouth was puckered in a pout of pure disdain. She stood beside the gurney, staring at him, testing her conviction, giving herself one last chance to take another course, rather than the one to which she had committed earlier. But she had no second thoughts. I thought Shenick and DJ Michael were the two heads of the snake, but they're gone, and the snake is still alive. I need to know the true power behind these Arcadians of yours, the one who sits on the ultimate throne. I need to know a lot of other things. Hendrickson shook his head no, playing the tough guy who would deny her even in this moment of his extreme peril. I could interrogate you like I have others, but you're as good a liar as the devil himself. I can't afford to be deceived, sent on some wild goose chase or into a trap. If it might be possible to convey a smirk with one's mouth concealed, Hendrickson smirked. There's only one way I can trust what you tell me. He raised an eyebrow. In January, we were still living in our house in Virginia, 2 months after Nick died. A scary thing happened. I'm at the computer, researching strange suicides. Travis is in his room, playing with Lego blocks. I don't realize some son of a bitch used a lock-release gun to get into the house. He's in my boy's room with him. Hendrickson's brow was not as smooth as it had been. This guy charms Travis with funny stories, sends him to me to ask what NatSat means, then Milk Plus. I think it's some little kid's game, but they're words from A Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess. It had a big effect on me in college, helped me go FBI. Travis comes in again, says Mr. Droog is in his room. So then I get it. In the novel, drug-crazed, ultra-violent thugs are called droogs. Travis says Mr. Droog is going to teach him a fun game called rape. Hendrickson's eyes were pale green pools of venom. So I keep Travis close, get my gun, search the house, find no one, just the open back door, Jane continued. Just then, the phone rings. It's Mr. Droog. He tells me if I keep investigating Nick's death and all these suicides, they'll snatch my boy and ship him off to ISIS or Boko Haram to be used as a sex slave until those savages get tired of passing him around. He says they might even do the same with me, so my son and I will have to witness each other's abuse and degradation. She closed her eyes and took a deep breath, because speaking about this, especially to this man, stirred in her a lust for violence that she dared not indulge. She looked down on Hendrickson again. This Mr. Droog had a distinctive mid-tenor voice, certain speech patterns that I told myself I'd never forget. Never. And I haven't forgotten you, Mr. Droog. When you came fully out of the chloroform, by the time you told me how much you liked to hear pretty girls use big words like hyperbole, I knew you. I knew you. She went to the refrigerator and took from it the MedExpress container and brought it to the table. An inset digital display on the face of the carrier read 39 degrees Fahrenheit, which was the interior temperature, well within the preservation zone for the contents. From her leather tote, she took a length of rubber tubing to be used as a tourniquet, a foil-wrapped sterile wipe, and a hypodermic syringe. Through gauze gag and duct tape, Hendrickson made interrogatory sounds that might have been words forming an urgent question. Jane opened the MedExpress container. The CryoMax modular cold packs were still largely frozen. She took from the container three generous ampules of cloudy amber fluid nestled in insulated sleeves, each bearing the same batch number, intended to be injected in the same session. They were some of the samples that she had taken from Berthold Schenick's house in Napa County earlier in the month, when she and an ally invaded the weekend getaway home of the inventor of the nanomachine control mechanism. She had wanted the samples as evidence. They were more than evidence now. They were an invaluable tool and a terrible justice. The sounds Hendrickson produced were no longer interrogatory, but instead exclamatory, a muffled but strenuous protest. I do regret this. But there's no other way with you, she said. No other way to get the truth, and I desperately need the truth, Mr. Droog. Fortunately, Schenek gave me what I need to squeeze the truth out of you. He began to thrash in his restraints, rocking the gurney, but there was no escape from the straps. She waited until he'd exhausted himself, and then she picked up the scissors and began to cut away the right sleeve of his white shirt. He tried to resist, but was ineffective. The cut sleeve came away and slithered to the floor. Goose flesh stippled his bare arm. His pale forehead glistened with a fine beadwork of sweat. 30. This must not be allowed to happen. This is an outrage. He is who he is, and he is not a candidate for adjustment. No one has told him that she might have ampules containing control mechanisms, which means no one knows about them. It's known the crazy bitch took money from Schenek's safe in the Napa house, and it's suspected she made off with his research files on flash drives, because he worked when in Napa as well as when in his labs in Menlo Park. But no one knows she's gotten her hands on ampules containing control mechanisms. Schenek wasn't supposed to have those in such an unsecured location. They should have been stored in Menlo Park. What the hell was the demented asshole thinking? The recklessness, the arrogance, the sheer stupidity. The syphilitic son of a bitch probably meant to use them on his hot wife, Inga, as domineering a witch as ever rode a broom. Maybe he meant to convert her into his personal version of an Aspasia girl. This is intolerable, unthinkable. This must not be allowed to happen. He is who he is. He is who he is, and she's a vulgar pleb operating out of her league. She's gotten this far on sheer dumb luck, that's all. As she unwraps the hypodermic, it occurs to Booth that perhaps some Arcadians know she's in possession of control mechanisms, but haven't told him. Depending on what cell you're in, what position you fill, you're told only what it's deemed you need to know. But he thought he knew everything. The ultimate insider. If someone decided that such knowledge was reserved for those above his station, there is no honor anymore, no integrity. Treachery is everywhere. Machinations, hollowness, treachery, and ruinous disorders. This can't be allowed to happen. 31. Jane unwrapped the hypodermic needle. She prepared it and the cannula. She tied the rubber tube around his biceps and drew it tight. With one fingertip, she palpated the veins in his forearm until she found one suitably prominent. She tore open the foil packet and used the antiseptic wipe on the injection site. Sounds of an entirely different character than before issued from Booth Hendrickson, a miserable, beseeching noise. The fingers of his upturned hand were spread and trembling, reaching out as best the strap allowed, much as a penniless and frightened beggar might seek alms. She met his intense stare, and with his eyes he implored her not to continue, seeking the mercy that he had never extended to anyone. The muffled cries escaping him now were as pitiable as the whimpers of a gravely injured dog. Gilberto came to Jane's side.
I'll do it. I have training.
No. Not you. Not this, of all things, she murmured. This is only on my shoulders. No one's but mine. As Jane prepared the first big ampule for intravenous infusion, Hendrickson began to cry like a frightened child, lost and alone in a dark woods. The woods were his life, as he had made it for himself, and the dark was the darkness of a soul so long untended that the wick of it had withered until it couldn't be lit to bring forth any guiding hope. She hesitated to administer the first ampule. She shuddered violently, as though an icy and invisible presence had for a moment occupied the same space in which she stood, before moving through her on its way into some nameless void. The human heart was deceitful above all things, hers no less than any other. In this perilous mission in which she found herself, the days were hard and the nights were lonely, and only two motors drove her onward. First, her love for her child and for her lost husband. Second, the conviction that in the perpetual struggle of good and evil, the latter must be resisted without fail. But there was a temptation to use the weapons of evil against it, and in so using them, to risk becoming the very thing that she was sworn to resist. She couldn't say without doubt that her heart yearned more for justice than for vengeance, and it was in the self-deception regarding motive that the long descent of the soul began. In the end, she could only depend on her belief and her heart's faith that her love for Travis and Nick was greater than her hatred for Hendrickson and his allies, because love, and only love, inoculated her against evil's infection. In memory, she heard Mr. Droog on the telephone that day in January.
Surely, for the fun of it, we could pack the little bugger off to some third-world snake pit, turn him over to a group like ISIS or Boko Haram, where they have no slightest qualms about keeping sex slaves. Some of those badasses are terribly fond of little boys as much as they are of little girls. You're more to my taste than your son, but I wouldn't hesitate to pack you off with him and let those Boko boys who swing both ways have a twofer. Tend to your own business instead of ours, and all will be well.
Now she met Hendrickson's pale green eyes again and said, Come hell or not, you are my business. It was no small thing to deprive a man of his free will, even if he believed that denying others autonomy over their minds and bodies was his right as well as the road to utopia. She served the first course of the 3-ampule infusion, and then the second. because a scream would no longer avail him of any hope of rescue, and because she sensed that it was her obligation to regard his face complete, even to receive his bitter curses as she reduced him from a man to a marionette. She stripped the duct tape from his mouth and allowed him to expel the sodden wad of gauze. He didn't curse her, after all, didn't speak, or even weep. When she opened the valve to feed the third dose into the cannula, she met her captive's eyes once more. He appeared to be horrified, stricken. But then, a subtle change came over him, and it seemed that in his eyes welled something like awe, as if he were gazing up not at a motherless widow desperate to save the life of her child at any cost, but as if she were some fierce aboriginal goddess, embodiment of ultimate power, figure of mystery and wonder. And there was about him an air of deliverance, as though his lust for power, which would now never be fulfilled, could as well be satisfied by giving himself to power, as though his burning desire to have every knee bend before him was but the mirror image of his heart's other and equal desire to live on his knees and kiss the ruler's ring. A fresh chill gripped Jane, but instead of shivering her as had the previous one, it coiled in her bones to stay a while. Part 3. Alecto Rising. 1. Gavin and Travis, facing each other from opposite ends of the blanket, each with his back against a tree, finished the brownies and sat listening to the canyon wrens, issuing a long series of clear whistles that cascaded through the cottonwood shade. Man and boy were comfortable with each other in conversation and in silence. In less than 3 months, Gavin had come to feel not just protective of Travis, but also fatherly toward him. And Jessica was as smitten with him as if she had conceived him and brought him into the world. Any wound that Travis suffered would be their wound. If anything happened to him in their care, the years that remained for them would be years of grief, aging into settled sorrow, and even the bright moments of life would be shot through with shadows. The boy said,
"I'm kind of getting sleepy here."
"Take a nap, kiddo. We're not in a hurry to be anywhere."
"You sleepy?"
"Nope. The only way I can sleep is hanging by my toes from an attic rafter."
"Batman," Travis said.
For now and then they played a little game in which Gavin said something ridiculous about himself, and the boy had to guess what secret identity he was claiming.
"That one was too easy. While you nap, I'll work up one that'll stump you."
Travis curled on his side, on the blanket, and let out a long sigh of weary contentment. From time to time, Gavin heard the buzzing of a drone, mostly in the distance. Though the aircraft surely had nothing to do with him and Travis, he didn't want to ride out of the cottonwoods until he hadn't heard one of them for at least 20 minutes or half an hour. He suspected that the boy knew as much and was feigning sleep, so that Gavin didn't have to keep making excuses for why they were not starting the return trip home. Travis had inherited his parents' good looks. He would be a heartbreaker when he grew up, but he would never break any, because he'd inherited their intelligence as well, and for a kid so young, he understood the concept of consequences, that one person's wrong action produced another person's pain. He had already been cured in the brine of grief, and a consequence of that was a regard for the feelings of others that few children had at his age, and that some people never acquired. He'd make a hell of a Marine if he ever followed in his father's footsteps. Gavin Washington had been an Army man. He and Jessica had met Nick and Jane at a fundraiser for the Wounded Warrior Project in Virginia 15 months earlier. Their friendship formed quickly, effortlessly, for they recognized in one another shared attitudes and convictions without the need to explain themselves. Sometimes it seemed to Gavin that they were brought together by Providence, in preparation for all the crap that was coming fast in Jane's life. Because both Gavin and Nick were spec ops guys, they shared an ingrained preference for discretion, for maintaining a low profile. Neither the Hawks nor the Washingtons were much interested in social media. There were no Facebook postings to link them, no Instagram or Snapchat accounts. They corresponded a little by snail mail, which left no indelible digital trail, and they spoke on the phone, but not often. Their friendship flourished face-to-face, at weekend-long events for veterans' causes in which Jessie had become an activist following the end of her own Army career. When Jane needed somewhere to hide her boy, family and friends with obvious connections could not provide her with a safe, secret redoubt. There had been only Gavin and Jessica, a continent away, but willing. The thing that most troubled Gavin about the drones was the length of time they cruised the area. Maximum flight duration for one of that size was probably 15 minutes, half an hour with a backup battery. He'd first heard these craft an hour earlier, and still the buzzing came and went. Of course, if there was a tournament involving a club of enthusiasts, they would have brought numerous replacement batteries. The wrens of both varieties were tireless in their singing, the rasping, scraping screech of a red-tailed hawk in triumph from time to time confirmed a good day's hunting. By contrast, in a silence came a large swarm of butterflies, Sarah orange tips, white with black, and fiery orange markings on their wingtips, harbingers of spring, lilting through the air like notes of a song translated from music into the hush of Lepidoptera. Their phosphorescent whiteness made ghosts of them in the shadows, but their true beauty flared as they danced through shafts of sunlight. Perhaps 20 minutes after the most recent buzz of a drone, Travis sat up into that delicate, busy flocking. Yawning elaborately to prove that he'd been asleep, he held out his hands, onto which a few butterflies alighted and flexed their wings and tasted his skin before taking flight once more. In ages past, various Indian tribes that roamed this territory had spoken of these butterflies as spirits that entered this world from another to celebrate the spring. Most said that they were omens of good luck and of healthy children soon to be born, although there had been a tribe that saw them as omens of death. Getting up from the blanket, Travis said, "Time to go home?" They had more than a 2-hour ride ahead of them. Reluctantly, Gavin rose to his feet.
"Yeah, I guess we better scoot."
The Sarah orange tips did not follow them when they rode out of the cottonwood grove and westward down the canyon. Gavin wondered to himself, which are we leaving behind, death or good luck? 2. In the ceiling light box, one of the fluorescent tubes faintly buzzing, fan-driven heat whispering out of a wall vent, refrigerator motor softly humming, a mechanical yet forlorn chorus. Faster than a cube of ice becoming water in the summer sun, Booth Hendrickson transformed from a vain master of the universe into a willing and obedient prisoner. With the infusion of the third ampule, his terror and horror faded with an alacrity Jane could not comprehend. The inevitability of his oncoming conversion into an adjusted person, as he had once so arrogantly named them, seemed entirely to quell his anger, to bleed away any thought of vengeance. More surprising than that, with all options other than conversion denied him, his fate apparently did not depress him, but instead appeared to float him into a tranquil harbor. He relaxed in his restraints and closed his eyes and spoke quietly, less to Jane than to himself. Words that might have seemed despairing, but were in fact given an inflection that made of them an expression of contentment.
"So here I am. It's lovely, isn't it? After all these years, back here, of all places, here in the dark, alone."
Jane looked at Gilberto, whose frown mirrored her own. Hendrickson said, I think to myself, I play to myself, and nobody knows what I say to myself. The hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, of tiny brain-tropic nanoconstructs teeming through his blood would take 8 to 10 hours to reach their destination, pass through capillary walls into brain tissue, and self-assemble into a control mechanism by virtue of Brownian motion. Hendrickson could not already have been in any way affected by their presence in his bloodstream. His inexplicable contentment, mere hours away from the loss of his free will, seemed to confirm a psychology so twisted, so tortured, that unraveling the reason for this complacent acceptance might be impossible. On the other hand, he was a prince of deceit. Jane had to assume that even with Hendrickson's future in chains from which no mortal power could free him, he was nevertheless scheming to use these last few hours to ensure her death, although he would have nothing to gain from it. He opened his eyes and looked up at her with no evident animosity. Why wait for the control mechanism to be in place? Interrogate me now. I'll tell you everything you want to know. The lies you want me to believe? No. Listen, later, when you have total control of me, you can ask some questions again. Check those answers against what I'll give you now. You'll save a lot of time that way.
Why should you care if I save time?
I don't care. But I'd rather not spend these next 8 hours just waiting. The newest iteration of the mechanism installs in 4 hours. I didn't know you'd taken ampules from Shenick's house. Maybe no one knew. They torched the house so fast to cover what happened there. But what you took in Napa, what you injected into me, that's an older version. Takes 8 to 10 hours. I might go a little crazy, don't you think? A little crazy, just sitting here waiting to feel it come together inside my skull.
Jane could imagine her anguish in this situation, and what she had done was a moral weight on her. She felt no guilt, but she recognized a responsibility to ease whatever foreboding he might feel during these hours of transition. Sympathy for the devil, always dangerous. When first waking from the chloroform sleep, still under the influence of it, he had revealed something that he wasn't likely to remember having disclosed. She tested him. Last week I learned the access sentence that brings an adjusted person under my control, so you people must have been busy reprogramming them.
Play Manchurian with me, he said. That's the one you know. Lots of plebs are accessed with that sentence.
Plebs?
Plebs, plodders, rabble, two-legged cattle. Just other names for the adjusted people.
His contempt for them seemed undiminished, even though he was about to join their ranks. How many of them are there? She asked.
Plebs? Right now, over 16,000.
Dear Lord, Gilberto said. And he went to sit at the table. And what's the new access sentence? Hendrickson didn't hesitate.
Uncle Ira is not Uncle Ira.
She had a clear memory of their conversation as he had first come out of the chloroform, not fully conscious.
Hey, sexy.
Hey.
I got a use for that pretty mouth.
I bet you do, big guy.
Bring it on down here. Uncle Ira is not Uncle Ira.
Who is he, then?
No, that's not what you're supposed to say.
What am I supposed to say?
You just say, all right.
A few exchanges later, he had dozed off once more. Now that he'd passed her test, maybe she should invest minimal trust in him. But first, she pressed him on his more recent, cryptic statements. You said here you were again, here of all places, in the dark, alone. She quoted the rest as she remembered it. I think to myself, I play to myself, and nobody knows what I say to myself. What is all that? What does it mean? Neither the soft voice in which he answered, nor his childlike entreaty was characteristic of him.
What I said? All that stuff is of no importance to you, only to me. So don't make me talk about it now. Leave me a little dignity. If you really want to know, wait till you control me. And then, after I've told you, just please make me forget I ever did.
Over Hendrickson had settled a hybrid mood that Jane could not fully read. A melancholy that his circumstances could well explain, but also a note of what seemed like a sentimental harking back, a wistful regret, and a curious sort of longing. His lotus-leaf eyes were without their former power, and his pride gave way to something almost like humility, his manner that of a mendicant.
All right, she said. Let's see if we can fill those hours for you. But only if we fill them with the truth.
3. Gavin Washington let Travis lead the way home on his Exmoor pony, the better to watch over him. The boy wore his riding helmet, which he disliked, but he wouldn't be receiving his longed-for cowboy hat until he'd had a few more weeks of experience in the saddle. Samson was a bit restive about the slow pace and would have liked to gallop full out or at least canter, but the stallion was always mindful of the signals from his reins and his rider's legs. Following the pleasant midday warmth, a late afternoon cooling had begun. Thin, high clouds seemed not to drift through the sky, but instead to form on it like a skin of ice crystallizing on the surface of a pond, glazed patches reaching toward one another with growing fractal fingers that blurred away the blue. The fitful breeze had become constant, though it hadn't swelled into a wind, rippling the sage not yet in bloom, shivering the spidery late winter flowers of coombe wood. Gavin remained alert for drones. Sometimes he thought he heard one in the distance, but getting a directional fix before the sound faded was hampered by the clatter of horseshoes on the stony soil, plus the creak and clink of tack. By the time they came out of the wildland to the gate at the back of their property, near 4 o'clock, Gavin no longer had any concern about the drones, which must have been flown by hobbyists. He could hear an aircraft circling high over the valley, but he hadn't detected even a suggestion of the comparatively shrill motor of a drone in almost an hour and a half. They watered the horses at the trough and led them into the stable and removed their saddles. They conducted them into their stalls and put on their feed bags. Later, after the horses had been fed and the tack had been properly cared for, when Gavin came out of the stable with the boy, the growl of an airplane crawling the sky caused him to search for a dark shape against the hoarfrost clouds. The craft wasn't within view, perhaps off to the north, and he assumed it was not the same plane that he'd heard earlier. 4. After Jane hobbled Hendrickson's ankles with a pair of cable zip ties, allowing him to walk only in a shuffle, she freed him from the gurney. With pistol drawn, Gilberto accompanied the captive to the bathroom, and a few minutes later returned him to the kitchen table. Jane used another 2 zip ties to link Hendrickson's ankle fetters to the rear stretcher bar of the chair in which he sat. She put her mini recorder in front of him. Wearing a patrol eyes camera around her neck, with a spiral-bound notebook and pen, she sat directly across the table from him. Her purpose was only in part to learn whom she needed to pursue to break the command structure of the Arcadians. In addition, his insider's testimony should be useful in the eventual prosecution of these conspirators, and it might later help exonerate her of the criminal acts she'd been falsely accused of committing. Gilberto sat witness. His pistol lay on the table, well out of Hendrickson's reach, in case he still had tricks to spring on them. A fresh pot of coffee, Slices of Carmela's ricotta pie and Hendrickson's new meek demeanor gave the proceedings an almost cozy context that felt surreal. At times, the exchanges between Jane and Hendrickson grew eerie, as he seemed eager to please her, not in the way a defendant might want to please a prosecutor or judge, but with the disturbing subservience that a child, browbeaten from the cradle and for years thereafter, might respond to a tyrannical parent. In curious little ways, he seemed to regress from adulthood as the interrogation entered a second hour. He asked for another slice of pie, and, eschewing the fork he'd used with the first serving, he broke off pieces of the treat and ate them with his fingers. He had been drinking coffee black, but now wanted a lot of cream and 4 heaping spoons of sugar, essentially making another dessert of the brew. At times, in the 3rd and 4th hours, his attention drifted away from her. For 10 seconds, 15, half a minute, he fell silent and stared into some private elsewhere. Always, Jane could bring him back to the issue at hand, but she had the impression that Hendrickson was slowly becoming dissociated from the reality of a life of submission into which he was sliding. She wondered if something might be going very wrong with the nanomachine implantation. As it self-assembled its cerebral web, might it be causing subtle brain damage akin to a stroke? But his speech wasn't slurred. Neither were there signs of weakness or paralysis. He didn't complain of numbness, tingling, vertigo, or impaired vision. He was more likely undergoing a psychological rather than a physiological fracturing. Supposing he was telling the truth, he'd already given her a treasure of information, though his revelations were limited because of the structure of the Arcadian cabal. In the classic tradition of spy networks and resistance movements, they were organized into numerous cells, each with a limited number of members, and those in one cell didn't know the identities of those in others. Access to the complete roster of Arcadians remained a privilege of those at the very top of the pyramid. Hendrickson, for all his former power and posturing, didn't know how far up in the Arcadian architecture his position might be. Considering his grandiose opinion of himself prior to the infusion of a control mechanism, he'd likely imagined that he was closer to the pinnacle than was the case. What she was getting from him, however, gave her tools to use and new people to go after. She had thought that the now-deceased billionaire David James Michael had perched at the top of the Arcadian pyramid, and she had taken enormous risks to get at him. For the first time since the shocking events in DJ Michael's penthouse in San Francisco, she might have a chance to tear apart the Arcadian nest and pull from it a writhing tangle of these vipers, bring them into the sunlight of revelation that they shunned with vampiric dread. Interrogation could be an exhausting process, especially for someone who was betraying every associate with whom he was entwined in criminal activities. It was no less tiring for the interrogator. Shortly before 5 o'clock, Jane called for a break. She'd had little to eat in the past 24 hours and needed to refuel to sharpen her concentration.
"I'll get some takeout," Gilberto said. "There's a good place down the street."
"Protein," Jane said. "Don't load me up with carbs."
"It's Chinese."
He suggested some dishes and Jane approved.
"You?"
Gilberto asked Hendrickson. The captive didn't answer. He sat with his hands upturned on the table, staring at his palms. The faintest smile suggested that he wasn't reading his future, but perhaps remembering things that his hands had touched and done to his satisfaction.
"Get him what we're having," Jane said. "He's in no position to be picky."
5. Subhadra labored through an eternal storm, or so it seemed, for the novelette would advance only grudgingly. Tanuja pushed with all her creative energy as if the narrative were a boulder and she were Sisyphus being punished for trickery, fated never to get the great stone to the top of the hill before it rolled down yet again. At precisely 4:45 p.m., she suddenly knew, intuitively, that she was nearing a breakthrough with the story, but she needed to step away from it and do something else for a while, something fun, and let her subconscious wrestle with the novelette. She saved the document and switched off the computer. She always worked by intuition. Whether it was a novel or a shorter piece, she didn't outline a plot, and she didn't produce character sketches before beginning the story itself. She just started to write, guided by the still small voice of intuition, which was like an open phone line to a higher power, one infinitely more creative than she could ever hope to be. Like an open phone line, yes, except it didn't speak to her in full sentences, but instead in isolate images and dream-flow scenes of action and hieroglyphics of emotion and enigmatic lines of blank verse that she then had to translate into comprehensible English, into meaningful fiction. But this time, the still small voice of intuition was in fact a voice that spoke coherently. Saturday night is for fun. Go have fun. Forget about Subhadra and her storm. Dress up. Go out. There is fun to be had. Do whatever you feel you must do to be happy. And tomorrow, you will write your best work ever. Initially, the clarity and specificity of that inner voice was strange, disturbing. But then, not so much. And then, not at all. She pushed her chair away from the desk and got up. She left her home office without bothering to turn off the lights. The time had come. There were actions to be taken. What those actions were did not matter. She did not need to think about them. They would come naturally to her, intuitively. She went upstairs to her bedroom. On a shelf in her walk-in closet rested a small black lacquered box with silver hinges. She had never seen it before, yet she had known it would be there. This did not strike her as peculiar. There were actions to be taken. What they were would become clear to her as she took them. She carried the box to her vanity and opened it. The first item that she extracted was a necklace of miniature human skulls carved from bone. Gleaming black onyx filled the eye sockets. The craftsmanship was exquisite, the skulls more beautiful than frightening. The box also contained four lovely gold bracelets fashioned as cobras. Durga, the goddess mother of the Hindu pantheon, was maternal and kind and the source of much life, but she also had dark aspects. The most fierce of those was her incarnation as Kali, often depicted as wanton, naked but for the darkness in which she wrapped herself, wearing only gold bracelets and a necklace of human skulls. In this religion, no separation existed between the sacred and profane. All things on the earth were aspects of the divinity. Kali, an aspect of Durga, had several aspects herself, one being Chandi, the terrible one. The Chandi aspect of Kali was often depicted with her four arms raised, instead of Kali's usual eight, hands gripping a sword, a noose, a skull-capped staff, and a severed human head. Of all the divinities, only Kali had conquered time, and she was, among other things, a slayer of demons. Tanuja Shukla did not share her deceased parents' Hindu faith, but she hadn't forgotten it either. She sometimes employed Hindu mythology in her stories as metaphor, for color, to evoke a sense of mystery, but never to endorse it. If she could have believed in a goddess, it would have been in the most benign Durga, not any of her less compassionate aspects, not Kali. But the necklace was quite beautiful. She draped it across her breast and reached behind her neck to click the clasp. 6. Hendrickson, hobbled ankle to ankle, zip-tied to his chair, hands palms up on the table, at first sat silently as Jane paced the kitchen. She massaged her trapezius muscles and rolled her head side to side to work a stubborn soreness out of her neck. The light at the windows would last an hour and a half, but the overcast would steal the golden radiance and scarlet dusk that could make a California day's end so enchanting. Following the events of the morning and afternoon, and considering those to come, nature's loveliest pyrotechnics couldn't have bewitched Jane anyway. Her mood matched the gray skies. At the table, Hendrickson muttered. When she asked what he'd said, he only smiled at his upturned palms. His expression had no dangerous edge. It was wistful, pensive. She suspected that he hadn't heard her, so lost was he in thought. She continued pacing, and, not for the first time, regarded her reflection in the brushed stainless steel door of the refrigerator. Her form was warped and blurred, her face a mask of shadows from which all features had been shorn, as though she had died and become a revenant. At the table, Hendrickson said, "Now is it true, or is it not, that what is which, and which is what?" She went to the table and stared down at him. His gentle smile was a storybook thing. The smile of a cat who learned to be friends with a mouse. The smile of a mouse who won his prize of cheese. The smile of a boy who survived a fearful adventure and sat now hearthside and home again. Jane was creeped out by it. Tethered to the chair as he was, he could make no move against her. Even if he had not been shackled, she could have handled him, taken him down. Nevertheless, she wished that Gilberto would return soon with dinner. 7. At 5:15 p.m. precisely, Sanjay typed "the end" in small caps. Although he had not reached the end of the novel that he had been writing for the past 3 months, neither had he arrived at the conclusion of a chapter, or even the bottom of the current page. He wondered at the words, almost deleted them, but then left them dark upon the white screen and saved the document. The time had come. There were actions to be taken. What those actions were didn't matter. He didn't need to think about them. They would occur naturally to him. Like his sister, Sanjay was an intuitive artist whose finest fiction was not first designed and then constructed according to blueprints. Writing was always work, always. But when he surrendered himself to the currents of creative energy that flowed from the mysterious headwaters of intuition, the source unknown and unknowable, he was at his best. Therefore, the time had come. The time not just to write intuitively, but to live intuitively. The time to do whatever occurred to him without first considering where his actions would lead. He left the room without switching off the lights. In his bedroom, he changed into black jeans and a black shirt, black socks and black rubber-soled shoes. He took a black sport coat from his closet, but did not put it on. Leaving the lights on behind him, he went down the hall and into Tanuja's bedroom. She was standing beside her vanity bench, waiting for him, as he had known she would be. She was quite beautiful, dressed all in black, wearing a necklace of skulls and gold bracelets fashioned as cobras. She wore black eyeshadow and black lipstick and black polish on her fingernails. They did not speak. There was no reason to speak. The time had come. There were actions to be taken. Sanjay sat on the vanity bench. Tanuja knelt on the floor before him and began to paint his fingernails black. Never before had his fingernails been painted. This seemed an odd thing for her to be doing, and a peculiar thing for him to allow. His uncertainty, for it was not a strong enough feeling to be called doubt, lasted only until she had painted the thumbnail on his right hand and the nail of the adjacent forefinger, whereupon nothing had ever seemed more natural.